So today, let's get going with some introduction. Just to remind you where we've been, 16th and 17th century, we looked at it in our first session, and the big picture thing there was about the shaping of worship, both theology and kind of the regulation of what went into worship. Last time we looked at 18th and 19th century, and we particularly looked at the issue of the influence surrounding culture, either fitting with it or deliberately standing against it, and then some of the reactions, some people feeling like churches have become too staid and fitting with their culture and wanting to kind of go back to basics, that kind of reaction. Today we're doing 20th and into 21st century, or kind of come up to date. And again, we'll look at lots of different areas. But if I was to give it a broad heading, it would be about responding to change. It's been a lot of change during that time, both theologically, we'll think about Pentecostalism and charismatic movement, but also societally and technologically, a lot of change. And how different churches have responded to that, I think, has been quite a key issue. It's a key thing that we will look at. And one of the results of that is that while there was already variety in the kind of corporate worship scene within evangelicalism, there was what you might think of as a mainstream kind of version. And I think because of a lot of that change, that kind of monolithic mainstream has kind of got broken up quite a lot. And it's interesting to observe that. So let's jump into the 20th century. And first of all, there was just a lot of what we might think of as standard services, the kind of things we saw already. I read out that kind of thing last time from the 19th century, kind of hymn, prayers, readings, sermon, more hymns, etc., conducted in an orderly way. The minister basically doing the vast majority of things, maybe. A secretary or a clerk helping in certain ways, giving the notices or something like that. Within that, there were more kind of manuals for worship published. We saw that new directory in early 19th century, and more manuals guiding people in worship came out, particularly within non-conformity. So a Congregationalist manual of worship, a Baptist manual of worship, continuing some of those themes we saw. How do you honor the kind of freedom that nonconformists have enjoyed and espoused, rather than a completely set liturgy? But how do you do it well? And how do you have some set prayers or use of scripture in prayer or in readings? Corporately and so on. So more of the same in that vein. The other area was new hymn books being published, and some of these were used kind of across denominational groups, like this one, Hymns Ancient and Modern, came out in lots of different versions during the 20th century. Others were more denominationally focused. Congregationalist praise was for the Congregationalists, the Baptist hymn book for the Baptist Union, and so on. Along with that is the issue of tunes, because if you look at the heading of this hymn book, it says Hymns Ancient and Modern for use in the service of the church with accompanying tunes. And I commented on this last time, but it's worth mentioning it again. Prior to the 19th century, lyrics and tunes existed independently of each other. Lyrics were written to certain meter, and you could then sing it to a number of tunes. Once you start publishing hymn books with an accompanying tune, you choose the tune that goes with that hymn, and that's what you sing it to. And although there's a sort of a theoretical flexibility that you could sing Amazing Grace to something different because the meter would work, you'd tend not to. And so lyrics and tunes get married together, and then people say, this is the tune that goes with this hymn. There was a continuation of a lot of Victorian tunes, some use of older folk melodies, some musical innovation, the kind of fitting in contemporary society. So in the early 20th century, some people tried to write some tunes in a kind of Gilbert and Sullivan type style, because that was kind of popular music of the day. The other thing to think about here with hymns is the idea of curating content. If you write a hymn, if you put together a hymn book like this one or the Baptist one or whatever, you have to decide what you're going to put in it. And the way you tend to work is you work in topics. So if you look at the, if you, I hope you know what the contents list of a hymn book would look like. But if you've not looked at one, go and have a look. There'll be stuff on creation, on God the Father, his providence, his care, sending of the Son, incarnation, Christmas carols, his life and ministry, death, resurrection, ascension, the church, the work of the Spirit. It's like a systematic theology in some ways, although slightly differently organized. And you have to say, well, which songs are we going to have about providence? And which songs will we have about the atonement? Because we can't have all of them. That is the idea of curated content. You have deselected, and you've said, well, if we're going to have this one, then we're probably not going to have that one because those two are too similar, and so on. And then you end up with this range of hymns and a balanced range of hymns. Now, of course, it's then up to any church as to which of those they sing. They may not reflect the balance you've given them in the hymn book, but at least they've got a balanced, curated kind of menu to choose from. Hold that thought in mind, because we're going to come back to how that's changed in more recent years and some of the challenges that can present us. So that's just a little summary on some of the standard services that were continuing in mainstream churches throughout a lot of the 20th century. But then we need to consider one of the biggest changes and the greatest change within corporate worship, and that's to do with the Pentecostal and the Charismatic movement. People talk about different waves in this. There's a little bit of debate exactly about which fits into which, but broadly speaking, people talk about the first wave being early Pentecostalism, 1900s, 1906 or 406 kind of area. This is particularly focused in the in the States, as the Azusa Street revivals you may know of is seen as the birth of Pentecostalism. Limited impact in the UK, but some. What was then much more significant was the second wave, which is usually referred to as the charismatic movement more broadly, in the 1960s. People like Michael Harper, Gerald Coates, Terry Virgo. This began things like the house church movement, where people broke away from traditional denominations, set up their own churches, meeting in people's houses, and often then moved to schools and cinemas and hotel rooms and so on. It was still called the house church movement, even when they'd moved out of houses. Often with more of a focus on gifts of the Spirit, so-called, speaking in tongues, prophecy, and so services now looked utterly different to what had been mainstream beforehand. The third wave is more debated. It's often linked around power evangelism and John Wimber in particular. Some people add in the Toronto Blessing, which came a little later than that into the 90s. Some people make that a fourth wave. Wimber was more about evangelism, not about corporate worship, although he did say things about that, but more about evangelism and the use of kind of supernatural gifting, like a word of knowledge. I now know something about this person and I can tell them about their affair or something. and that will convict them of the gospel. The Toronto blessing was much more about corporate worship and what you experienced, and a whole variety of different kind of manifestations of the Spirit and effects of the Spirit, apparently, within corporate worship. In this country, seen within things like some of the HTB, Holy Trinity Brompton Network, but also then seen in Charismatic Anglican, Charismatic Baptist, and so on. Now, this was, as I say, the most significant development in corporate worship for a long time. It transformed the worship of some churches. It split many churches. And even when not taken on board directly in more conservative churches, it had a knock-on effect eventually in different forms. It's worth dividing up some of the different issues that are involved within it. Some of it is purely theological. What is our theological kind of content on certain areas? So baptism in the Spirit as a post-conversion event, that is the marker of Pentecostalism. And it was the marker of the early Pentecostal revivals. A lot of you are Christian believers, they would say, but you don't have the Spirit. You haven't been baptized with the Spirit. And so that your Christian life is at a very early stage. It varied in charismatic circles as to whether that was stated or not. As I say, it's a true marker of Pentecostalism. It can be true within charismaticism, depends which version you're encountering. Tongue speaking was particularly significant, both in Pentecostalism and in charismaticism. In Pentecostalism, because it was taken from Acts 2 and Pentecost, that speaking in other languages or tongues was the marker of having received the Spirit. And if you hadn't, you hadn't received the Spirit. But it was then seen as an ongoing manifestation of the Spirit. But then more broadly, there are the gifts of the Spirit, things like prophecy or words of knowledge, miracles, and so on. And so there was a lot of debate about these areas. A lot of churches, I think it's fair to say, in the mainstream, were functionally cessationist in various ways. And this was now a huge challenge. And so people were debating their theology of the work of the Spirit, particularly in corporate worship. And what did we think the Spirit did or didn't do? Do we think tongue speaking is for today? Do we think prophecy is a current phenomenon, and so on? But then other stuff is what I would call theological / stylistic. And I'll explain why. For example, contemporary music and instrumentation. So rather than singing traditional hymns to an organ, in the 1960s, you have the rise of contemporary Christian music, singing choruses to a guitar. Now, because we've done this series, we should know that there have been moments like this before, with debate over what we sing and what we sing it to, and there have been changes. So this shouldn't be a massive surprise to us. The reason this caused such ructions was, I think it was a change that came in after such a long established, settled period of what corporate worship and singing in particular would look like. I think we can look back now, and I don't know what you think, having to guess what's going through your head. In my head is, this is just stylistic. It doesn't really matter if it's a guitar or an organ. Why is that such a big deal? At the time, it was seen as theological in various ways. People would speak of this bringing the world into the church. You know, guitar and drums have no place in the church, for example. And so it caused far, far more heat than we might thought. If you're old enough, you'll know some of that heat in your earlier years. Secondly, emotion and expression in worship. And again, we've seen this previously. We've seen it in Watts and Wesley and in the revivalism stuff in the 19th century. we've seen some of the reaction to formalism in the church and people saying, no, it ought to look different to this. So again, I think some of our history might just give us a better perspective. But in charismatic worship, emotion and expression was front and center. Aside from use of gifts generally, that we might feel something in worship, in a sense, experience God in worship and express that in new ways, hand raising, kneeling, dancing, whatever it might be. And again, I would say an awful lot of that is stylistic. But some people thought it was theological. And I take it there is a theology behind it, at least. But then lastly, there was the issue of the contribution of the congregation in worship. Previously, everything had been done by the minister. I think this is actually one of the things we should be very grateful for in the charismatic movement, is the idea that people brought contributions. Now, whether we agreed what those contributions were or not is another debate. But the concept of the body and gifting of the body in connection with use of gifts, and that the use of gifts are for the building up of the whole body rather than the minister is the only voice you hear, that's a theological issue in our ecclesiology. As I say, this is the most significant change. I think it had something of a reaction to formalism. I mentioned that last week, a sense of rediscovery of, first century church. Again, we saw that with things like the primitive Methodists. As I say, it resulted in some churches transforming within their denominations, say Baptists becoming charismatic Baptists, but the start of new house group movements and so on. Also the fracturing of some churches. Now, if we broaden from that, the charismatic Pentecostal movement specifically, and just think about some of the worship debates that flowed on from that, and I'm thinking now more specifically of debates within a kind of more conservative evangelical kind of setting. Some of these debates centered around style of worship, traditional versus contemporary, organ, hymns, very ordered, versus any kind of contemporary music and contemporary instrumentation and any kind of expressiveness in worship. And this is sometimes referred to, particularly in the States, as the worship wars. It was never quite a war in the UK, but it was certainly a bit of an argument. Some would say that the traditional ways of worship which were quenching the spirit. Others would say charismatic worship was strange fire, if you remember that phrase, the kind of the creation, you know, a man-made creation offering God worship he'd never asked for. So pretty strong language, but again, language that we have seen previously. There was also a debate on the purpose and focus of worship. And I think this becomes very pointed for us and helpful to reflect on. You get both charismatics and non-charismatics, conservatives, kind of questioning, well, what is the purpose of worship? If the charismatics are saying, for example, we meet God in our song and we experience him, and the conservatives saying, no, we don't. People started to say, so why are you singing? What is happening? Is corporate worship only about the sermon? There's a lot of discussion and articles in magazines and other things around worship. Romans 12 gets quoted a lot. Romans 12, 1 and 2 about offering yourself to God, this is your spiritual act of worship. And so people would say, we don't go to church to worship, because worship is all of life. And so there's a lot of debate even around that term at this stage. People would say, so saying you go to church to worship is like saying you go to church to breathe, that's just part of life. Okay, so what are you doing? And I think people came up effectively with different answers. Some people, I've got some diagrams for you, some arrows in different directions. I always like an arrow. Some people spoke still of, we are gathering to worship God. Charismatics would speak that way, but interestingly, some more traditional conservatives would speak that way. It's the Lord's Day, it's a worship service. We gather to give him praise and worship him. And so the primary movement is us to God. Others would speak of hearing from God. And so that primarily would happen within a sermon, but even within songs, you might say, well, we're reminding ourselves of God's truth. So primarily, God is speaking and ministering to us. Others started to talk more about edification. Things like Colossians 3 speak to each other in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. And so, if you asked, what are you doing in singing before the sermon? We're building each other up. We're speaking the word to each other in different ways. We're not worshiping God, we're speaking to each other. And then others would speak more of evangelism. We are proclaiming the word outwardly. So, as I say, some charismatic and even more traditional conservatives would speak about worship. This is where some Sydney Anglicans in particular were quite influential in talking about edification and speaking to each other. Some people were starting to be influenced by the seeker-orientated movement in the States, Willow Creek and others, where it was more emphasizing evangelism. So, slightly different influences and debates going on. What are we doing when we gather on a Sunday? Now, if you look at those different arrows, I wouldn't be surprised if you'd like to say you'd like a little bit of each of them. And I don't blame you. I want a little bit of each of them. And I think when we look, we haven't really done this in this series, but if we looked at a more general theology of worship, if we looked at the Psalms, for example, as a model, I think we'd see some Psalms which are calling us to worship God directly. I praise you. I exalt you. Some are, come and hear from God today when you hear his voice, don't harden your heart. Others are speaking to each other, come let us. And others are proclaiming the truth to the nations. So I think you see that kind of variety. Having said we want all of it, I still think it's worthwhile churches reflecting on this as to, if you think about it as a set of volume controls, which one, I think some churches will have one of those volume controls turned up more than the others, or some turned down more than others. So what is it you think you ought to be doing as you gather, and how is that then expressed? Particularly, as I say, towards the end of the 20th century, this was one of the debates rocking around, but I think as a kind of a slightly slow burn knock-on effect of the charismatic movement and all that was being said about worship. Let's move on to the 21st century, and just sort of like some recent issues. And I say 21st century, some of this is still 20th, really late 20th, but I'm just trying to divide it slightly neatly. And I just want to deal with some more recent issues where there have been points of debate, and I think some kind of changes loomed in the 20th, but have really come to the fore in the 21st. So the first one is just in terms of songs, the issue of updating words. And you see it in hymn books. For example, the Praise hymn book came out in the year 2000. It's relatively well known, quite widely used. And it decided to update the words of old hymns. So archaic language, these and thous and, behests and whatever were all modernized. And that, of course, required changing some of the wording because you can't just change the to you because it now won't rhyme with C or whatever it was 2 lines later. So you have to change other lines as well. And they were accused of playing around with, the great inheritance of the church in its hymnody. If you have a copy of the Praise Hymn Book, I doubt many of you have read introductions to hymn books, but if you read the introduction to this one, they will have a section in, there's a section in there entitled, Why Did We Dare Revise? Because they knew what they were kind of playing with fire in doing this. That's just one example, but the issue of do we update classic hymns has is there just more broadly around today. It's just worth saying some people say that the old language is language of respect to God, calling him thee and thou and so on. Historically, that isn't true. Thee and thou were used of people just as much as of God. It was just the second person singular. You might say to somebody, I pray thee that you da da da. Well, I'm talking to a person now. I'm not talking to God. I'm requesting something of you. It did then become something used of God and not of people because language had moved on, but people kept on praying to God using thou and so on. But that was a kind of an odd moment where language hadn't caught up. Today, by and large, everybody will speak to God in prayer using contemporary language, and it's only our hymnody that is behind the curve. So that's just worth noting. Let me just give you some examples just to see what the effect it has. Here's a stanza from Come, O Fount of Every Blessing. It's the second verse. And I've put in bold some of the key words. Here I raise my Ebenezer from 1 Samuel about raising a stone. An Ebenezer is a stone of help, from the Hebrew for stone and help. By thy great help I've come, thy good pleasure. Jesus sought me when a stranger wandering from the fold of God. That's obviously a sheepfold, but the fold of God wouldn't be a term we'd use. And he interposed his precious blood. Well, interposed isn't a word we'd use today. And so the modern version would say, I remember God's great mercy. By his help, I've safely come, wandering far away from God rather than from the fold of God. And he shed for me his precious blood. Those are the sorts of changes we're talking about. You can think of other famous examples. Oh, sorry, my mind's going. Thine eye diffused a quickening ray, famous line. Well, thine rather than yours diffused a quickening ray. I mean, I take it we know what that means. He worked by his spirit to change us and our hearts. But that is not language you would use in a sermon today and expect people to understand you. Before the throne of God above has the line, my name is graven on his hands. But we don't talk about graving things today. The modern version says written. All people on earth do dwell has the line, him serve with mirth. Well, mirth today, it's not a word we use very much, but if you use it at all, mirth is kind of frivolity or laughter. When actually what it meant was joy, and that's what the new version means. So there are a number of issues here. There's archaic language, and there's the fact that language changes over time in its meaning. I haven't got it written down for you, but I'll give you my favorite version of this from Isaac Watts. So, if you know that God's providence is often spoken about as his frown or his smile, so a difficulty in life is God's frown, it's a hard providence, right? And if you know that biblically the emotions are located in the stomach or the bowels, because that is the biblical word used as to where you feel. Well, if you have those two things, Watts then writes a line that says, of God, while he frowns, his bowels move. I dare you to sing that in public. While he frowns, his bowels move. What it means is, while he gives a hard providence, he feels for you in it. But language has changed. And I think we should change our hymnody with it. Some people say we are disrespecting the original authors. I don't think we are. A lot of them changed their hymns as time went on. They have been changed over time. I think we're to sing with understanding. And that means singing with normal language. So I am an unembarrassed advocate for modern wording. But that is an area of debate today. Second area is updating tunes or using new tunes. Many hymns, well-known hymns, were sung to Victorian tunes, which tend to be a bit stiff. And they can have a certain grandeur to them, but they can be a bit kind of school chapel feel. And today, what people tend to enjoy singing and feel easier singing is a more flowing tune, which is one reason why Celtic tunes are so in vogue compared to a more stiff, kind of regular Victorian kind of tune. Or older folk melodies are often used. And I think this is an example of contextualization, that you sing what your people find easy to sing. I'll give you an example. Many of you, I'm assuming all of you will know the hymn Before the Throne of God Above, and you will all probably immediately be able to think of the tune that it is currently sung to, which is a beautiful tune. It's the one where the last line is repeated twice. That tune was written in 1997 by Steve and Vicky Cook from Sovereign Grace. Before then, it was sung to a very traditional Victorian style tune. And the result is very few of us sung it. Because although the words were brilliant, it felt very stiff and formal. And that new tune has given those brilliant words a new lease of life. Now, for people of a certain age, that's the only tune they've sung it to. So they don't know that's the new tune. Whereas for an older saint in your congregation, it might be, oh, why can't we sing it to the original? You know, you've changed it. Yeah, we've changed it, and I think we've improved it. Of course, at some point in the future, that tune may fall out of favor and someone might write a new tune to it. And I think that's fine. The problem is, of course, some of our older saints in particular, a certain tune will be so associated with the hymn that they find it hard to sing anything else. And we need to help people with that. You see it with other tunes as well. When I survey the Wondrous Cross, again, I imagine most of you will be able to think of the tune we tend to sing it to. It's a kind of it's actually a very old folk tune. So it's not newly written, but in the UK, it's not the traditional tune it was sung to. But I think it's given it a new lease of life and is very helpful. Then there's the issue of new technology. Particularly with the internet, people can now listen to recordings. Prior to that, you could buy a Spring Harvest CD or whatever and listen to high quality, well-produced Christian worship music. But then particularly with the internet, you can listen to whatever you like from wherever you like, usually with very high production values. The other thing that happened was you used to have your hymn book and you'd sing whatever was in it and you couldn't sing anything else. Then people might start, because printing became cheaper, people might start to print either addendums to it, or you'd even print something for that Sunday. So you print the lyrics for each week. But you'd still have to go out and buy a new music book to be able to sing new songs. And people would go to things like Spring Harvest and come back with Spring Harvest 96 songs, and we could now learn some new songs. Today, you could hear a tune this afternoon on YouTube, and you could go to Song Select and print out the music and sing it on Sunday. So it's changed from publishing those old hymn books and choosing a hymn to go with it. That change isn't bad. In fact, I think that's brilliant. It's wonderful that we could hear something today and sing it on Sunday. But what we have now lost is any sense of curated content, because you can just choose whatever you happen to have heard today and think, oh, I like that. Let's sing it on Sunday. And this raises the issue of who chooses songs. At least previously, who was choosing songs had to choose from a certain book, which the church had spent a long time deciding which hymn book to get. You know, that would be quite a big decision, and that would set your singing for the next decade. Well, that's gone. You can sing whatever you like now. So who gets to choose? Who gets to choose whether you can sing a new song on Sunday? Because the person leading might say, oh, I heard this one yesterday. I liked it. Let's learn it. Do you have then any balance across your repertoire? No, let's not sing that new one, because actually we've got lots of songs on that topic. We need some songs on this topic. Who has that type of overview, if anybody? The other thing that can happen with this new technology is a kind of musical consumerism. You can hear whatever you like from a vast range. I'm sure you've come across this in other areas. Greater choice can actually result in greater narrowness. So, with the rise of digital TV, for example, if you want to watch old episodes of Top Gear all the time, you can watch them on Dave. And having more channels available doesn't mean you watch a wider variety of things. It can actually mean you watch a narrower variety of things. Similarly, musically, you can just listen to what you like all the time. And this has led into what is then usually called worship consumerism. And I think there are a few factors that flow into this. The first is individualism. The 20th century was always an individualistic culture, but there's arguments to be made that we have become more individualistic. That means it's a focus on me and my experience of corporate worship. How do I find it? It's the kind of closed eyes, my experience of God, rather than the opened-eyed, I'm glad that Doris, three chairs away, is enjoying singing her favorite hymn, even though it's not my favorite hymn. Secondly, there's the effect of popular music listening. And I don't want to overstress this, because it does, I think there's great variety here. But if we just do a kind of brief overview, it used to be that to listen to music, you had to go to a concert. Because there was no other way of listening to music, and you went and you sat and you listened and you were focused. Now, the rise of the radio, you can have music on and so on. So that's been around for a long, long time. But if you accelerate forward to today, you can listen to whatever you like, virtually wherever you like on your phone. And music, for many people, as background, has become very common. Now, of course, it varies. I don't mean people don't really listen to what they're listening to or focus on it. Some people do massively. But the idea of music as something that I have to specifically listen to and engage with versus it just kind of provides background and atmosphere, and I kind of drift through it. That has been noted as one of the effects of popular music listening. Not for everybody, but for some. And that can mean people approach music in church effectively as something I just kind of listen to, and I might sort of sing along a bit if I want to, as opposed to I am focused and engaged, and we are singing together. And then lastly, the seeking of experience is one of the knock-on effects of the charismatic movement, a greater expectation of experience. People will speak, sociologists will speak of the idea of like entering what they call an affective space. That is, I go into church and I'm expecting now to feel something within this space and all that happens within it. I encounter something. And churches have often given in recent years far more thoughtfulness to what we might say is the aesthetics of worship. The space that you're meeting in, lighting, the kind of the mood, even, and I doubt this is true of many of your churches, but it could be, I've been to some churches where there's even background music, very low level background music, just during a lot of the service. You know, someone's talking, but there's just a low, they're called pads in music terms, the sort of chords being played that just add to the atmosphere. Now, I don't think all of that is necessarily wrong. I think aesthetics exist and some things are done well and poorly and so on. But there's far more thought around that and the idea of an experience in corporate worship. This led Don Carson to come out with what I thought was one of his best quotes, and I'll give it to you here. Despite the protestations, one wonders if we are beginning to worship rather than worship God. It's a bit like those who begin by admiring the sunset and soon begin to admire themselves admiring the sunset. I think that last slide is brilliant. The idea of you're sitting there admiring the sunset and then you kind of go, look at us. Isn't this an enjoyable experience? I'm admiring me doing this thing. Admiring might be the right word, but I'm focused on my experiencing of something and what it's doing for me, rather than focused on what I'm doing, which is, say, praising God or thanking him or encouraging my brothers and sisters. What is the dynamic in worship? The dynamic in worship is not about what I'm experiencing. I don't mean our experience is irrelevant, but that's not the primary dynamic. You'll need to reflect for yourself how much that's an issue for you and your churches. I'm not saying it is. I just think it's a recent factor within corporate worship more broadly. So let me bring this to a close with some key lessons across both centuries. There's our theology of worship, and particularly our understanding of the work of the Spirit in corporate worship. We've obviously been touching on the theology of worship, but that's a separate set of kind of seminars. But that's a key issue that's being raised. What is it that we're doing? Could you say to your congregation, here's why we meet and what we do when we meet? Could those leading your services do that? When I've done kind of training for those leading services in our church, I've often begun with that question. Let's try and put in one sentence, what are we doing when we meet? And it's peculiarly difficult to get people to do that. And I think it's because we don't have a very good theology of worship. Secondly, the place of emotion and expression. We've seen that through this series. What place do we think it has? What do we expect people to feel? I take it we are not anti-emotional, but we are wary of emotionalism. And that provides certain boundaries and guidelines for how we want to try and lead. The involvement of a congregation within corporate worship. These last two centuries is where it moved from the minister to more of a variety. Do we have particular convictions on that? What do we think ought to happen in that? And so on. The idea of curating content. particularly over our songs. It was curated in hymn books, and you had to choose which hymn book you used. Now it's open season. How do you manage that, and how do you oversee what it is your church sings? And then the idea of battling consumerism. You may remember if we go back to the 17th century, 16th, 17th, we talked about what worship is acceptable to God. In consumerism, the question is, what worship is acceptable to me? What do I benefit from and I experience? And I don't mean that asking, will I get out of it, is a wrong question. I don't think we should slam people for that. But we need to help people see what is happening in corporate worship more broadly, before we ask that kind of question.